but now.
Is that all?
It's a larger card. We just have a bunch of episodes on here. I was rebacking them up the other day. I got worried that I couldn't find the files for Twister, but they're I had to use the ones that were attached to the video. I always worry about that when I transfer files back and forth, and something's going to get lost.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, future me, this is Spinal Tap. Spinal Tap. I often listen to the first 10 seconds, and I have to listen forward. And, yeah, that's about 16 seconds in where I said that. I have to skip forward to figure out where it is sometimes, especially if I go back, because I only put them in by date. So I can look them up by date, but it's just the filing system I've always had for data that comes in like that. So that's just a future reminder to me. All right, you ready?
Yep.
What the hell is this? Oh, it's the wrong number from earlier. Somebody sent me an address. They're like, can you be here tomorrow? And I thought it was like a job. And I was like, that address is in California. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, who do you think you're talking to? And they're like, Amy, right? Like, no, you were way off.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. I was like, I can't make it to California. They're like, oh, it sucks. We're having a barbecue after. If you're in the area, you could come. I was like, I'm in Texas, so no.
Well, at least he invited you.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. All right. Hello, 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 everybody. I am Pedro.
And I am Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot.
Yes.
The grittiest show about reboots there has ever been.
With two sick hosts.
Today we are doing the show a little bit on the on the disabled list. I was going to say the download, but that's a different thing. Two different DLs. But you can be on both, oddly enough. However, you're pretty sick. I'm just starting to get sick. Yeah. You're getting over.
I'm getting over.
You're over the hump. I'm just about to go into the hump.
Yeah.
I'm going to hit that hump and hit it hard.
Yeah.
And even with that, I'm still putting on the podcast gloves, letting you hear that audio of me putting on the glove.
Can they really hear it?
Yeah, well, because you're going to smell the glove. See, I worked it back in later. And why are we going to do that?
I don't know.
Because we're covering Spinal Tap.
Oh.
Yeah, you remember this is a podcast.
Yeah, but you were talking about smelling gloves and everything?
That's the name of the album in the movie.
Oh, really?
Smell the Glove, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the whole controversy.
Okay.
So, okay, this week we are breaking a little bit of tradition. Spinal Tap does not have a reboot, but we are talking about movies that basically have a spiritual successor.
Yeah.
And I think we are going to take a look at one, possibly two movies, but we are definitely taking a look next week at Pop Star Never Stops Stopping, I believe is the title of that one.
It's a fun movie.
And that movie is in a very similar vein to this one.
It's not as good as Spinal Tap.
It's not as good. However,
but that it's still
movie,
entertaining.
That movie is weirdly underrated today for as good as it is. It's like Walk Hard is another movie we might think about. It's not quite the same kind of movie, but it does poke fun at the same tropes of the music genre and just the music industry in itself. But that movie was a horrible failure when it came out, Walk Hard. I remember watching Walk Hard with my buddy Matt, and we were like one of four people in the theater. And I think opening weekend numbers were like $4 or $5 million. The movie was just forgotten to time
with
John C. Reilly, his brilliant parody of Walk the Line, featuring Joaquin Phoenix about the life of that guy.
Johnny Cash?
Thank you. Johnny Cash and his wife, June Carter Cash.
Yeah.
I remember June Carter, but I was like, what's the guy's name?
Johnny Cash.
John Cash. He was a man at that point. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. He's dead.
Yep.
We need a grave digger.
Oh, that doesn't count. Sure. That doesn't count for the kill count of the show?
Yeah. Why not?
All right. So, but yeah, with that being said, this week we're taking a look at Spinal Tap because this isn't the first mockumentary. There are others before this film. But this is probably the first important one and probably the first comedic one that ever really caught real fire.
Yeah.
That wasn't like a TV show or simply kind of a one-off thing. And these movies, even though Rob Reiner didn't direct them, they really spawned their own, you know, Christopher Guest franchise or universe of films. You know, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, which I really like. And some of those guys are here. Some of those cast members aren't here. Like Eugene Levy doesn't show up. You like Eugene Levy, correct?
Yeah, I do.
A lot of people don't.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I listened to a podcast while doing research for this. And obviously, everybody fucking loves Spinal Tap. But they were talking about the future Christopher Guest films. And I like Waiting for Guffman quite a bit. I think that's a great movie. And I think Best in Show is good, too. And I like Eugene Levy in it. But I know a lot of Christopher Guest fans are like split if Eugene Levy ruins his movies.
Jeez. Eugene Levy is one of the funniest people ever.
A lot of, like, I want you to know, like, usually we are pretty keen. Like, we are deep in the film closet about knowing our references and following the cool people. You know, yeah. We're not down with Emilio Perez. Then we think it's a piece of shit. We are so normie right now for loving Eugene Levy.
Really?
We are like my mom watching a movie. Like, oh, Eugene Levy's a funny guy. Like, that's how other, like, hardcore movie podcast guys, like, they like Eugene Levy. What a bunch of normies.
I don't remember where I was at, but I was talking to a young girl, and she was talking about how much she hated Will Ferrell. And I was like, oh. How do you hate Will Ferrell?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's normalized us, but you got to remember, and I think I remember this conversation. I forgot who it was, but I remember this conversation, I think. But he's just so inundated in our generation mm-hmm. that even if you were around, if you didn't get all those movies and now you sort of are left with this version of Will Ferrell, kind of lumbering around, hasn't made a classic film in a long, long time, right?
Yeah.
It's been a long time since he's made a great comedy. He sucks in that respect, right? Like, if you don't like Christmas movies, I mean, who the fuck is Will Ferrell to you, yeah. right? If you've never seen Anchorman and Talladega Nights, like his two comedic gems outside of Elf, you know, who is he to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the thing. I think Sandler, despite his output being mediocre, his output is very in line. You know, I think if you watched Happy Gilmore and enjoyed that, I think you could still enjoy one of his movies today, even though it's updated slightly. His feel of his movies is still very much the same.
Uncut Gems is one of the best movies I've seen.
That's the thing.
And he's so good in it, and he is being himself.
Even as mediocre as the comedic career has been, because he has really wanted to make movies his own way and keep the style and feel of them almost the same throughout, no matter what he's yeah. doing. But when he has left that genre, I think he's made really rewarding cinema, like Uncut Gems. I think I'll have to explain to people in my 60s how he didn't get nominated for an Oscar that year.
I'm telling you.
Yeah, people are like, how didn't he win? I was like, he didn't get nominated. I was like, the movie just picked up steam late. And sometimes that's kind of weird. Like, a movie or a performance just picks up steam in December when the Golden Globes have already been voted on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, just a movie like that doesn't really get thrown into consideration. People don't understand something's going to be a classic if it gets released late or too early. I think it was might have been the other case with Uncut Gems that came out in February because they didn't think it was that kind of movie.
Mm.
And poor Sandler missed out. I mean, listen, he's doing fine, but you know, he's had a couple chances to be nominated for an Academy Award. And I think of all the comedic superstars, now the best performance is still Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But that is like the one anomaly, really. I mean, he's good in The Truman Show. But, like, otherwise, Carrey's work is just all right.
Yeah, but he's transcendent in
yeah.
Spotless Mind.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. He deserved an Oscar nomination yeah. and win for that one. That was the best movie of that year. That yeah. was the best movie of that decade. But you
one of the best movies I've ever seen.
And listen, we're going to start doing the best of the year. We'll be a little bit late on that. We've had a little setback here in our schedule, as you guys know. We've been late to record this episode. We've had a little bit of a gap. Meredith dealt with a personal tragedy here over the last couple of weeks, and we're trying to get back into the groove here. So we will have new episodes coming and try to get back on our regular schedule of once a week here. But expect Best of the Year to be a little bit late. We try to get to it early February, probably after Valentine's Day when we start doing our worst and best of the year list.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, we'll roll that right into talking about Oscar and how they're maybe going to fuck this up.
Well, if you want to tell us how shitty that plan is, you can email us at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com.
That's right. Meredith has always enforced the importance of the email. However, if you're a little more modern, you can just go to any social media system and type in social media system. I think that's shown my age. And just search for Gritty Reboot, and you'll find us there. We're the only real Gritty Reboot you can follow. And we got clips from the show. You can send us messages and ask us questions, and we'll answer some of them on air if we have them.
But we're not doing a podcast about Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler.
We are not, even though we you know what? We struggle with other banter a lot of times before we dive into the movie. And today we have talked for almost 20 minutes about just rather inane stuff. And you know what? I actually had a pre-topic I wanted to mention to you, which was how you felt about the Fantastic Four trailer.
Oh, it was good. But do I have like any faith that it's going to be any good? No. We've been here like 3 times now.
Yeah. I don't have a feeling one way or the other about the movie, and I guess that's a problem in itself, but I don't have a negative feeling about it. So that's about the only real positive takeaway. I was excited to see the outline of Galactus, so that leads me to believe they're going to correct the mistake of the original franchise, which, listen, as we covered that then, it was just sort of a jokey movie, and things were different then. You didn't want a superhero movie to be that serious.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something you could do, you know. Like, Sam Raimi was walking a fine line when he did Spider-Man 2, because nobody had done that. Now it seems weird not to have, like, an emotional core to a superhero movie, but that was a fine thing to do in 2002. Nobody cared. Mm-hmm. So, it just how things change, and the way they portray Galactus as the cloud, him actually being what he's supposed to be in the comics, is a little more interesting.
Yeah.
I will say that. So they're on the right direction visually. I think they've got a pretty good cast. It looks really nice. Marvel could really stand to take some more chances with their cinematography. Everything has that high-end TV show look.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. Everything looks like an HBO show lately out of Marvel, and I really hate that. When I get it, it's all the green screen and stuff that they do.
Yeah.
And how homogenized the productions are. But that's how they're able to get those productions to, you know, at the price they get them. So...
Disney
either way,
is a big corporation.
Yeah, you know, yeah. They're about to say they've mid-maxed the whole thing. They've gotten the most out of their dollar, but it does make the Marvel movies look a little bland. As I said, you know, there's the cycle of movies you try to get excited for. I think it's tough to be excited about anything MCU, but they didn't make any missteps here, so that's solid.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give it a minor thumbs up at this point to steal Roger Ebert's gimmick that someone stole from him before he died.
Yeah,
I'm taking it back. Taking it back. Thumbs up. Gritty reboot, thumbs up, one thumb up. You don't care, but I'm giving it one thumb up. You are hand flat is what you are.
Well, I'm thumbs up. I'm positive.
Oh, you're thumbs up. We got two thumbs up. That's our new thing. No. I looked at the camera, it's not even there. I don't know why I do
that. We shouldn't steal something from somebody that you love.
He doesn't have it anymore. We're stealing it from a company that took it back from him.
That's true.
Yeah, they took it from Ebert when he could no longer speak. They were like, well, we're just going to take the two thumbs up trademark back. And he was like, what? I made that.
Yeah.
You know, so, and without him, it was worthless. They did a spinoff show that lasted, I want to say it lasted 2 years, because they, you know, everybody just orders the Ebert package already. You know, they're like, okay, well we want the review show. And after that, it was gone. It was just a blink and gone.
Through two decades, 17 classic albums, countless unforgettable concerts.
That's totally triumphs. Just Harry Shearer.
They changed the face of British rock music forever. And the best part is, they're back.
You can kind of hear Skinner in there. Get out
there, you're on! Now, they're on the verge of the greatest comeback of all time.
Rock and roll!
So
I know this will be a little bit weirder for the younger members of the Gritty Reboot audience, but there are a lot of people out there who, much like the Blair Witch Project, thought this movie was real.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who really believed that when they saw it.
But it's dry as fuck. Like, the humor is not overt.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, very much a mockumentary.
If you are used to, like, The Office, there's no one who's going to look at the camera and be like,
yeah.
Like, there is no little moment like that. There's a rawness to this movie.
Yeah.
And because it is kind of rough around the edges, this movie drips with an authenticity that filmmakers dream of.
Yeah.
And Rob Reiner nails a rockumentary movie like it's no big deal. Yeah, like he just... like
1984.
Yeah, like he just... like it really does seem like it could really be a legitimate music documentary about a failing band.
I read over and over in my trivia facts, like they had to like consistently put on the media of the packaging and everything for the movie that it wasn't a real rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And because I listened to a podcast today and they had a music industry executive and she was telling a story the first time she saw it. She just assumed it was a straight documentary. And just some band she'd never heard of or worked with before.
Yeah.
And she's just like, you know what happens? And even the ending, she had just sent an American band to Japan because one of their albums just finally got released over there and went gold. And so she was like, yeah, so that tracks. So, I mean, everything in that movie like made sense to her. And it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years later, she met one of the actors and was like, wait a minute. And it really dawned on her that movie had been an outlandish comedy, a comedy that was so good and authentic. Like she just never dawned on
yeah.
her that it was supposed to be comedic, you know,
because
it's just the way it is. And I think to us as a layman, there's so many gags, so many jokes that work even today. I think that that's what's unique about it. And like a lot of comedies, what sets them apart, I think, there's a lot of movies that are funny, but the movies that people come back to and they care about is because, like I always talk to, you know, Beating Heart. This movie has characters who, I don't know if you necessarily want to hang out with them, but they are sure as hell fun to watch.
Yeah.
You know, Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, and Harry Shearer, they do a great job injecting life. This is a great cast playing off of each other.
Yeah.
Like, these guys really feel like they are a rock band.
Well, they actually are musicians in their own sense. Yeah,
it shows.
Yeah.
It shows.
They play those.
Well, just the little moments I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but one of the moments I love is when they're in the pods and Harry Shearer can't get out. Is he continues to play, struggle, and then, oh shit, my part. And he continued to play. And those little moments make the illusion come through that these guys are a band.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that we talk about. Like, when you start seeing something that makes an illusion fall apart, you know, you question it. And even now, looking back on it, you just don't question it. Even though I've seen, you know, Better Call Saul and Michael McKean do years of acting.
Yeah.
And Coneheads. I don't know why Coneheads was the only other credit I could think of for Mr. Michael McKean. But it's just a testament to the work here. Like, even if you're making a comedy, you're still doing great acting work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is a movie that's, I think, all improvised except for one line, so.
Yeah, that's impressive.
And yeah, and you can really see it in the cast. There's so many times you can see, like, Christopher Guest just came up with an idea and he's going to start riffing on it. And I know I'm already getting ahead of myself, but like the start of Stonehenge is one of my favorite moments, because it's just a little moment when he's like, no one knew where they were from or what they would do. And you can see he's working out where he wants to take this. And he just, it's so funny to get boring inane chatter to be funny, because he has no idea what to do. He's just stalling for time so he can keep playing his guitar solo.
So how do you have an improv set when you have a script?
Well, you're still following a narrative, you know, so you probably have some lines written that you want to get to, but they aren't really a necessity, you know, because that's the thing. Improv actors are going to go back and forth with each other because that's just what they're good at, what they love to do is, you know, just talk about and question and go back and forth and just play with a topic. You know, I'm sure the script was probably like 50 pages and a lot of it was like, you know, yeah, me and Harry Shearer will just bullshit for like 2 or 3 minutes here.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that's probably what it is. Or it might have the start of a conversation and, you know, they just go off and tell a story and get into it. You know, let's talk about the movie's most famous moment.
Top to, you know, what we use on stage. But it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of 11, and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you're going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
You know, and see, what I wanted to play that with for is because I guarantee you it just in the script is these go to 11 is the opening joke. And he's just like, okay, let's just riff back and forth until we find something funny. You know, we'll go back and forth. And that's what it was. You know, they just... He focused on, you know, okay, you know, you can't get any louder. And Rob Reiner's whole gimmick was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And then what's presenting with it, his brain just imploded. And there's so many great little gags like that in this movie that come from improv. And I know there's hours of footage and a lot of people think there's different scenes, but it's probably just the same scene. You know, it's like, okay, now tell a different story, you know, or hey, let's grab a drink of water, come back and let's do a whole different setup to this joke. And, you know, they went a different way with it. And there's a lot of that in there. And I remember the Criterion disc that had...
I was going to ask if they had a Criterion.
They did. This was a Criterion. This was an old school laser disc, by the way, for Criterion. It did have a DVD transfer very early on, much like I talked about when we covered RoboCop. RoboCop had a Criterion DVD, but it was just a transfer of the laser disc. So it didn't have all the DVD bells and whistles. But it had some old stuff that never, ever made its way over. And it had a commentary track by the actors and everything like that that's lost to time now. You know, I didn't check if that's on YouTube. I meant to look for that. the DVD and I think the Blu-ray ported over a commentary track with all the actors in character. And it is an excellent listen. There's only one time like Michael McKean breaks down at one point in the middle of it. But for the most part, they hold character almost all the way through. And it's, like I said, a great little tidbit.
I miss that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a great special feature. And I wanted to listen to it and just ran out of time. I really did. I just ran out of time. It's something I thought about was going to back and checking out that commentary track. But that's a good one. Now that we've blabbered on for so long, can we get some facts?
Yeah, I have a few.
Okay.
The actors are all competent musicians and they're actually playing on the soundtrack.
So we have to mention that the soundtrack is really fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, I know they're joke songs, but they don't sound like joke songs. Mm. They sound like legitimate tunes that they are.
They wrote them.
Yeah, that they are sort of parodying of those sorts of eras and stuff like that. You know, I was thinking that earlier as I was playing some in the car, and I was like, you know, these really aren't bad tunes in themselves. You know, like, even Big Bottom's not that crazy with how songs were in the 80s. If anything, they just got...
Fat Bottom Girls?
Yeah, if anything, they became less ridiculous over time. Yeah. And that was, of course, the direct parody at the time.
After the film opened, several people told Rob Reiner that they loved the film, but he should have chosen a more well-known band for a documentary.
Yeah, to me, like, that's hilarious.
Yeah. In his memoir, Father Joe, Tony Hendra admits that he attempted suicide the night before the first day of the filming. He credits the joy he experienced in making the film with bringing him back from his depression.
Well, that's cool.
Right?
That's very cool.
It had to have been a fun set.
Yeah, I would assume
so. Rob Reiner doing all that coke.
Yeah, all that improv going back and forth, you know. You know, and this, you can tell this, you know, this is a low budget movie.
Several rock stars have commented on what an uncanny, accurate spoof of the rock and heavy metal world this film was. Ozzy Osbourne said when he first watched the film, he was the only person who wasn't laughing. He thought it was a real documentary. YouTube guitarist The Edge said, "I didn't laugh, I wept. It was so close to the truth." Marillion had five drummers in the space of a year between their first two albums, which guitarist Steve Rothery later admitted was like Spinal Tap.
Yeah, so, you know, the jokes were spot on is really the key point.
Yeah.
So many musicians and music industry people really thought this was a legit thing.
Yeah. In 2002, the Library of Congress deemed the movie culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant and selected it for preservation in the United States National Film Registry.
As it should be.
This is Rob Reiner's first film to be selected. The second would be The Princess Bride in 2016.
Yeah, he'll probably get Misery inducted as well. Rob Reiner has passed, has he not?
I think he's still... Carl Reiner's, obviously.
Oh, Carl Reiner's is passed. Sorry.
Carl Reiner.
I get my
Reiner's. Rob Reiner's still going.
Okay, I get my Reiner's mixed up. Sorry.
Yeah.
Don't you hate it when you mix up your Reiners?
Right?
Yeah.
I think Nick Reiner is still alive, too.
Oh, good. Nick Reiner.
He's a raging drug addict.
A raging drug addict.
Yeah.
See, we're not improv people. Raging drug addict who? Oh, sorry.
There was a deleted subplot involving an all-female opening act from whom all the members of the Spinal Tap contracted herpes. In several scenes of the finished movie, the band members have visible cold sores.
And you know what?
I noticed that, yeah. And I was like, what?
Even though it's unexplained, it still fits in perfectly that they would be rife with, like, STDs.
Yeah.
But weirdly enough, for a movie about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, there's a lot of rock and roll, but almost no sex.
Right?
Yeah, almost no sex. I don't think anybody does any drugs.
No.
Besides a cigarette, yeah. That's, yeah.
Dana Carvey is a mime in Fran Drescher's party along with Billy Crystal. Now, I recognize Billy Crystal, but I did not recognize Dana Carvey.
I recognized them both on the first viewing I had of this movie. So I think Bruno Kirby is there as well. It's another character actor. He was in City Slickers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Contrary to popular rumor, the Too Small Stonehenge Disaster is not a parody of Black Sabbath's oversized Stonehenge sets from the Born Again tour. The Stonehenge Spinal Tap scene existed as early as 1982, when the film was a 20-minute short. Black Sabbath didn't begin using their Stonehenge sets until 1983. The Stonehenge scene was likely inspired by the setup of Led Zeppelin's final two U.S. concerts at the Oakland Coliseum, July 23rd and 24th, 1977. The stage was framed by large Stonehenge-like monolith. Additional Stonehenge models appeared on the stage, and large banners to either side of the stage featured images of Stonehenge. The concerts are infamous because several members of Led Zeppelin's entourage beat up the local crew members backstage after the first day's performance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Rock and roll!
Yep.
It is what it is.
Kiss bassist vocalist Gene Simmons has said that a lot of the film was based on the band and that they themselves once experienced a moment much like the Hello Cleveland scene. They were playing in a theater and their dressing room was on the fourth floor. They went down to the first floor and found nothing. Second floor, nothing. Then they could hear themselves being introduced since it turned out to be the first floor or the third floor.
I assume that had to happen to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I assume that had to happen to somebody. They heard one story and they pass it on. And it's
one of my favorite gags in the movie because they're like lost.
Yeah.
They keep talking out loud about it.
Yeah. They're rock and roll. Hello. They're excited and they run back in. The guy, oh, no, you came back this way. You got to go. So is that all the facts?
That's all the facts.
Okay. When was the first time you saw Spinal Tap? Did I show it to you?
No, I had seen it as a kid.
Yeah.
I want to say I was probably preteen when I saw it.
Oh, you probably saw it earlier than
I was young.
Yeah. I saw it in high school. I had read about the movie. As the internet came around, it was one of those movies that I could read about. So I was very curious to sort of see this, you know, mockumentary.
Yeah.
Without really even understanding, you know, what that was. It would just be funny. And I said I was lucky enough to get my hands on the Criterion disc. And I watched that and I loved it, thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And it lived up to the hype and everything like that. And I think I inhaled all the special features and everything like that back in the day, really loved the movie. And then eventually, you know, bought the newer DVD when I had the opportunity. And oddly enough, that is the very same DVD that we watched. I never upgraded from that moment.
My older brother was a big fan of the movie. That's
oh, yeah. I saw well, it. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So it was one of those movies that, like I said, I'd heard about, and when I saw it, I was like, oh, you know what? That was a great movie. It lived up to the hype. So yeah. I was very pleased in that respect. One of those few movies that actually really did that because I'd heard so much about it by the time I really sat down to watch it.
Yeah, I don't remember feeling any which way about it because I was probably too young to understand what it truly was. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until high school when I fully, truly enjoyed it.
So one of my favorite first-time viewing experience stories is we were on vacation
visiting
Colorado with a friend of ours, and we knew because there'd be some bad snow, there'd probably be a couple of days we were just going to be, you know, stuck in the cabin.
Yeah.
Like, we weren't just going to be able to leave because of the snow and the ice. And while we were in there, I was like, okay, well, I will go and I'll bring my hard drive that's got all these movies, and, you know, I'd plug it into, I was going to say Nvidia Shield, but it was way before they had one of those.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was running. It might've been an Ouya, who knows? But I brought one of those, and so I was like, okay, well, we'll have, you know, these 1,000 movies that are on the drive, and you know, we were going down them, and obviously our tastes sort of aren't quite the same.
Right.
But I was trying to find something that he could watch, and I think at the time Rick was about, like, what, like 50, let's say 50s?
Well, probably 60s.
Probably early 60s, yeah. You know, we were in our, probably like 30, right?
Yeah, it was before Maya was born.
So, you know, obviously we had a disconnect, but I asked him as I was going through the films, like, have you ever seen Spinal Tap? And he never heard of it before. And Ricky's been, you know, he loves rock music. Absolutely loves it. You know, I've been going to concerts a long time. So I was like, oh, you might really dig this movie, you know? And he watches that and he laughed his ass off.
Yeah, he loved it.
Every single gag. And it was great to watch the movie again. I always love watching Spinal Tap, but it was almost great to watch him like
through his eyes.
Oh, they can't find the stain. Like, yeah. You know, those little moments like that, you know, the things, not more black. They're just all these, like, you get to see them for the first time. It's a very unique and nice experience.
He got the movie absolutely almost immediately.
He was down for it, like it's like he was just I mean, like I said, he enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And I still remember that fondly to this day. It's one of those things. I remember introducing a neighbor to when I was in college to pro wrestling. His son watched it, and you know, his dad came in and watched it, and then he was watching it with us, and I laughed because he's like, wait, is that a kendo stick? Like, he was just generally excited for, and I've been watching wrestling at that point for already 15 years, so I was dead inside. So it was nice to see somebody get excited for like one of those cliches, and that's the moment I think about. Just, it was cool to see something I love and someone's like, oh man, this is so funny.
Yeah.
So that was cool to spread that along, and I love telling that story, and now we have it on the show.
Going through this movie is a little different because it is so much like an actual documentary that like writing notes on it was a little weird.
That's why this part I knew wasn't going to take as long. That's why I wanted to talk about things that just kind of came to my head.
So we're totally going to go through this pretty quickly.
Yeah. Because there's not like a plot element to go to this party.
Yeah.
Now they're at this show.
Rob Reiner, he's the interviewer in this.
Director.
Yeah. The director of this.
Yeah.
Well, he is the director.
Yeah. But he is playing a character who is directing the movie.
he talks about Spinal Tap's part in history, and you get shots of the band walking through the airport.
And yeah, so we get basic, you know, music documentary stuff right here.
They start doing their rocker shtick. Reiner interviews the band. There's a black and white performance, and this is where you first learn that the first drummer has died.
Yeah, first of all,
we need a grave digger.
And so, yeah, we learn about this, the gag about the drummers, but I think that the gag that I really like, and there's a lot of gags I love, but I love that Spinal Tap changes throughout time.
Yeah.
Until they find this rock sound. And that's more of a direct parody of The Who. If you listen to like their early attempts together, it's a lot softer kind of music than the darkness that they would sort of go to and the epicness they would find later in their career. Hmm. And so I think that's kind of the parallel that's here early on, is they have like some Beatles-esque, you know, 60s pop. And then they get psychedelic, you know, they go through all phases trying to find something that will work for them.
Well, that first drummer died and he was replaced by Stumpy Joe, who choked on vomit.
Yeah. And not his own vomit.
It's someone else's
vomit. Yeah. And so that's another great moment of improv between just those guys riffing off of each other. I'm sure they probably have like 80 stories or 80 different versions about how every member died as they probably went back and forth. They probably burned through so much celluloid.
The band goes to a party with young Fran Drescher.
So yeah, Fran Drescher is a baby here, but she doesn't. Now she doesn't have a signature voice. Like she does, she's doing whatever she can to hide that accent.
That's what she's been told.
Yeah. So yeah, she's doing whatever she can to hide it. Yeah. No, she's good here. Everybody's good here. This is where we get the Billy Crystal cameo. There's a lot of great gags here at the party that continue on. But it is good to see some of the little cameos. Even though it wasn't much of a cameo, she was just a working actress at the time.
They all hop into a limo and with a chatty driver who talks about Frank Sinatra, and the band ends up raising
that's Bruno Kirby
window.
That's Bruno Kirby. That's a great gag.
Next, they perform again and it's the Big Bottom song, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
So funny.
The looser the waistband, the deeper the quicksand, or so I have read. With that, there is one clip that I have to play.
We're very lucky in a sense that we've got two visionaries in the band. You know, David and Nigel are both like poets, you know, like Shelley or Byron, people like that. They're two totally distinct types of visionaries. It's like fire and ice, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel my role is to be kind of in the middle of that, kind of like lukewarm water.
Yeah, another great gag to go out on. Okay.
Reiner continues his interview. He reads them some album reviews.
So I enjoy this one as well. I remember watching I Love the 80s, and I think it was Quiet Riot, and they released an album that was like condition critical, and the review from Rolling Stone was 1 star, condition terminal. It was great because it was the Quiet Riot guys who were telling this story, and you could see the lead singer like wince in pain, just like remembering that review.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be fair, Quiet Riot sucks.
Yeah.
They got the one song and that's it.
The label is having a get together and Fran Drescher gets on Ian about the cover of the new album being super sexist.
But is it really that sexist?
And Ian's their manager.
Who's great, by the way.
Yeah.
Another great performance in this movie.
Reiner interviews David and Nigel. He mentions the main audience is boys. So their whole audience is boys.
Yeah.
It's not anything else.
Yeah. They don't know a single female listener. Yeah. Or she got lost all in a Sam Goody, if that was a thing in the 80s. I'm just a record store.
This is where Nigel complains about the size of the crackers or the meat or the food in general.
Oh, yeah.
He talks about how the size of the bread and that it doesn't fit his meat. He has to fold the meat.
Yeah, he's got a little tiny. Yeah, these are the concerns of him. He's like, once again, these guys would find anything around them to just start riffing off of and try to come up with little gags. And this is another example of that. Like, if we just wrote down the jokes and stuff like that, we'd be here for like an hour and a half breaking down how each one of them comes up and how they react.
They perform and Nigel has to be helped off the floor. It's so funny because he leans back too far.
Yeah.
One of the guys from the back comes and picks him up.
Yeah. So he does that rock star move where he just leans back like that. I always enjoy that when Hayley Williams does that. But the thing is, she can get back up on her own. It's hilarious when they have to come and help him up. Another great performance gag.
Nigel talks about guitars to Reiner. And this is where you get his amp goes to 11.
Yeah, we get the amp goes to 11. Yeah. My other favorite gag out of this bit is where he has the guitar and he's playing it with the violin, which is a great gag. And he's going back and he stops. He tunes the violin just slightly. And he's like, yeah, that's better. I just love it. Oh, now it's perfect. And he continues screeching an awful noise out of it. Once again, just great little moments like that. I know I'm going to say great little moment over and over again on the show, but it's the only way to keep really describing this. It's another smile moment. Like, as you watch this movie, you're holding back your smile, waiting for the gag and the punchline to come up.
This is the part in the documentary where, you know, they go to a hotel. They only booked one room instead of the whole floor like they were supposed to.
Yeah.
The manager tells them the gig was canceled and there's more cities start to cancel as well.
Yeah, things are really going shit for Spinal Tap as the sales are tanking and they're now taking out their manager.
The band goes to see Elvis's grave and David and Nigel harmonize and argue a little about harmonizing.
So this is a subtle music joke because this is for three musicians who can't fucking harmonize together.
Yeah.
Fuck it, you know? You know, as someone who's known some musicians and things like that, like the idea that these guys could nail a harmony like that is just a really great gag.
Yeah.
You know?
There's footage of Spinal Tap on their 70s psychedelic phase.
Yeah, we get another installment in this whole bit of them going through their transformations through their career.
Peter James' band was their drummer, and he died by exploding on stage. They think
we need a grave digger.
They think he spontaneously combusted.
A lot of people spontaneously combust. It's just underreported.
We get to meet David's wife, Janine.
So Janine now becomes a major character in the movie. She's going to be have her whole plot line of trying to steal away control of the band. Which is,
how many times have we heard this?
Yeah, she's pure Yoko-ing this situation.
Yeah, on VH1 Music, you know, the behind the scenes. I just dated myself.
No, that's fine. Everyone understands the behind the music 90s reference.
Yeah. They get the album and it's black and nothing else.
So this was the solution here that the label came up with. Instead of the Smell the Glove album cover, which is them, I think they had a girl tied up and they were making her smell like a glove by a hand just coming off screen. Instead, they just get a black cover. And then we get the...
I think he's right. There's something about this that's so black. It's like, how much more black could this be? And the answer is... None.
Is that good? This movie is so funny. The band performs again, and this is where they come out in pods and one gets stuck.
Yeah, like I talked about this earlier. I love this gag. He doesn't break his way out to the very end.
Yeah.
He continues to play no matter what.
And then he has to go right back in it.
Yeah.
Reiner talks to the current drummer in the bathtub about how he feels about the previous luck of the previous drummers. You get to see that guy briefly. He's not really in much of the movie.
Yeah, you feel like he probably has like a lot of stuff that's on the cutting room floor.
But he ends up dying.
He does.
The documentary.
Yeah, not throughout the documentary. He dies the one time.
Whatever.
He only dies the one time.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, he's not like Lazarus coming back to die.
David and Janine talk to Reiner about their relationship. Mm-hmm.
Even though he does get one of my favorite gags in the movie. He's like, what would you be doing without rock and roll? This is way later on. He's like, well, if I could just have the sex and the drugs, I don't really need the rock and roll. That gag has always stuck with me for a long time. That man was a drug addict who just happened to play the drums pretty well.
Nigel plays alone on the piano. The band goes through the airport security and the bassist keeps going through the security and setting it off.
Yeah, they keep trying to find it with the wand and everything like that. And this leads to the gag, him stuffing his pants. And he pulls out like a giant cucumber wrapped in foil. Yeah, because I believe in the concert footage the night before, we'd seen like the giant cucumber like stuffed in his spandex.
Yeah. The band does promotion at a record store, but no one shows up.
It's a great just pan as they show no one in the record store and the band sitting there dejected.
Probably my favorite gag, the band heads to the stage, but they get lost and they have to stop and ask for directions.
Yeah. So once again, another legendary gag in this movie, probably happened to tons of musicians. This movie just really nails it. And it's one of those things, like, you look for it every time you watch this movie. You're just waiting for the gag to hit, and when it does, it's still a great one.
Yeah. You
know? Like I said, this is like listening to just like a classic rock album you love. You're just waiting for the riff to hit a lot of the times, so and it's just great to see again.
This is where Janine gets into the Yoko phase, but Nigel picks on Janine because David brings out some drawings of the band as animals, and they're talking about how
they want to do like a kiss thing.
Yeah.
This is a good gag. Janine's misunderstanding. I know we might not be here, but I love this clip.
You don't do heavy metal in Dublin, you know? I mean,
In Dublin.
She means Dolby, all right? She means Dolby. You know, it's perfectly well what she means.
One of my favorite parts of that, and you don't capture it here because obviously it's just audio, but she looks down so sheepishly when she makes the mistake, which leads me to believe she was just delivering a line of dialogue and just forgot the name was Dolby for the sound type. Because she looks down and kind of smiles like off camera, you know, just away from the scene. And it's just a genuine reaction of being embarrassed. But there's little moments like that in this movie all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Rob Reiner's able to inject a little expertness and just in the fine little moment.
Reiner asks Nigel how he feels about David. Nigel plays a violin on his guitar, and he's trying to be so metal. The band performs as David and the gang. They have this Stonehenge thing that they're trying to do.
So, Stonehenge. You missed the Angelica Houston cameo, which is...
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, Angelica Houston shows up as the designer for one moment, and she is given Stonehenge to design, and she was given Michael's drawing, and it is... sadly, inches instead of feet.
Yeah, it's tiny. It's 18 inches, I believe.
Yeah, so it's just like a foot and a half tall, basically. Now we're in the scene, right? You're already there.
Yeah.
The thing about it's great because rewatching it, like I said, you're waiting for it to hit. And as I looked at it for the first time, I thought about when we watched it with Rick and he started watching this scene and you don't know what's really coming. You see this joke here. Obviously, they can't use it. And I mentioned earlier, you know, Christopher Guest does a lot of great job with the improv and they don't know where they were, what they would do, you know, just the pointless monologuing in front of a stupid rock song. And, you know, it just continues to escalate. So you're like, okay, are they going to do something cheap? Like what's the gas going to be? And then over time, the Stonehenge comes down and like the laughs sort of begin, like you sort of start chuckling. And then it kicks it into high gear with the do 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 do, and then some dwarves start coming out and dancing.
Yeah.
And the scene goes to 11, to quote the own movie, that, I mean, it just reaches this comedic fever pitch.
The band argues with their manager about the tiny monument. They think he needs help. So the manager quits because he won't work with Janine.
Not for one think that the problem was that the band was down. I think that the problem may have been that there was a Stonehenge monument on the stage that was in danger of being crushed by a dwarf.
The best low-key gag is at the very end of that. Like, there's this emotional scene where he's like, okay, you're out of the band. You know, some big plot developments happen. There's just a moment of silence. And Harry Shearer's like, so I have to ask, are we doing Stonehenge tomorrow? No, we're not doing fucking Stonehenge tomorrow. Because it's just, take a breath, and he just delivers that one gag saying the stupidest fucking thing he could at that moment.
Reiner interviews Nigel about David and their relationship, and Nigel and David argue. Derek talks to Reiner about Nigel and David's relationship. The band goes to perform at an Air Force base.
So we had Fred Willard here, who is a longtime contributor to these kinds of movies, and it's Christopher Guest's, as he would pick up from this, and obviously people are familiar with him.
They play a very sexually explicit song in front of the Air Force.
Yeah, and there's like a bunch of people covering their ears. They are not the audience for it. Now, listen, how shitty is Janine, you know, how shitty is this to be booking this kind of gig?
Yeah, right.
Now, listen, here's the thing. SpinalTap wasn't doing a great job, so maybe she's doing the best she can. Maybe she's calling around.
She doesn't know what she's doing. Yeah,
this is all she can do is get a dance, a military dance. All she can book for a three-time gold-selling artist.
Well, all this ends up leading to Nigel quitting the band. And they start performing without Nigel, and it sucks.
That, you know, you're lumping Nigel in with these people that you played with for a short period of time.
Well, I'm sure I'd feel much worse if I weren't under such heavy sedation, but still in all, I mean, you've got to be realistic about this sort of thing.
And once again, just I had to throw that in there because it's just another great little gag. So I want to mention something here. The movie loses steam when he leaves the band, but... that is literally the point of the story.
Yeah.
So I know I've heard people be critical of it, but I was like, well, when he returns later on, it's like, yeah, Like, you, as an audience member, you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you can feel it because he has some of the best guests. And there's still really funny stuff that's going on while he's gone. But there is something missing. And I think that's one of the things that makes the movie work, because you feel it. The band isn't whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the movie's different now because the band isn't whole. It's just not some plot development. You know it as an audience member,
yeah,
without really realizing it. Like, yes, that's the thing. But you can see it everywhere. You can feel it, how the movie has changed.
Yeah.
And I think that's Rob Reiner's expert direction. Because the movie has to lose some momentum here so you can pick that thing back up at the end.
Yeah.
But I think them getting booed with the jazz.
Yeah. Someone asked David if this is the end. And Nigel eventually shows up and to see if they want to reform the band and tour in Japan, because apparently they're really popular in Japan right now.
Yeah, yeah. I Love Pump was blowing up over there or whatever it was. So there's a couple of jokes I really like. When they're at the party before the last show, you know, they made it to LA and this is their party about wrapping up the tour. They are talking together and they're like, yeah, we have other projects we can do. What about the, what about the Jack the Ripper musical, Saucy Jack? And then Michael McKean sings a couple bars and you can tell Harry Shearer has never heard this before. And then he just joins right in. And they sing a made-up song about a happy Jack the Ripper. And the other bit in there is, I thought about playing some of my songs with the London Philharmonic, which is a great gag. And Metallica would do that very same thing in, yeah, like 1997.
Yep.
About 15 years after the movie came out. It's all, people made that joke the whole time that they were doing it. And as I said, when he shows back up there, Christopher Guest comes back into the movie, like, you as the audience member, like I said, you're thrilled to see him back again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David performs without Nigel, but eventually Nigel joins him on stage.
Yeah, it's a good moment. Yeah. Like, he was the artist member. You're happy to see it. Those guys belong together. They love each other. Are they a great band? No. Are they good musicians? Hardly. Do they deserve success? Not likely. But listen, they're still working hard.
They're buddies.
Yeah. And it's nice to see. They don't have to be great people or amazing individuals, but this doesn't mean we can't, like, love them and identify with them, yeah, as an audience member. And, like, I will never forget these characters here. And we only get them here, that one commentary track, and a Simpsons episode.
This movie was rated 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, got a 4.6 user review, and a 7.9 out of 10 on IMDb. So one of our highest rated movies we've ever done.
Truly a classic film.
You should see the bar of 5-star reviews. It's ridiculous. So, in keeping in light, I went with a 1-star review. This review is called, "This is overrated."
There's got to be one guy out there.
With 3 exclamation parts.
Ooh, we wanted you to know it's ultra underrated, or ultra overrated.
"This is yet another movie regarded as one of the funniest comedies in the AFI Hall of Fame that doesn't even deserve to be a runner-up. Who are the members of the AFI? I'd like to have a word with them. This pseudo-documentary, pseudo-comedy starts out with a few funny gags scattered here and there, but in the second and third acts, when the band goes downhill, the comedy becomes as soggy as a wet rag. The gags are so slight and cheap, we're stuck with bland gags like the one about the tiny sandwiches in the dressing room. Wow, is that a classic moment or what? Just one bland gag after another. Even though the running time was a mere 83 minutes, I found it tedious and lagging. This is one of those comedies I have to watch with somebody to actually find which moments are supposed to be funny. I probably still won't get a laugh, but at least I'll have more of an understanding. Is this film true to the world of rock and roll, and does it have a satirical bite? I don't know. Maybe. Whatever it was, it sure as hell wasn't interesting. I don't know much about rock and roll as far as behind-the-scenes stuff goes, but I don't care what happens off stage if it's going to be this boring. If you want to see a good film about rock and roll, see Almost Famous. Better yet, if you want to see a much better mockumentary about the music business, see Fear of a Black Hat."
Oh, yeah, that is a great movie.
"A much more scatological comedy, but a much smarter and entertaining one as well."
I thought about doing that as well, but I know you'd probably never seen that.
Is that the rap one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that.
There's a couple different rap. There's CB40 with Chris Rock as well, yeah, that I thought about. So there's more than a couple ones for rap that could be done. And there was an MTV original movie about boy bands that people seem to really hold fondly.
Mm.
But, you know, c'est la vie. yeah, it was nice to hear from someone who truly despised the film.
Yeah.
This is a pure 10 out of, for me, this is one of my favorite movies, and yep. I look forward to seeing it every time. It is an absolute treat.
It's in my top 10.
Yeah.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Yeah, it is.
And so, yeah, so next week we're going to be taking a look at Popstar, Never Stop Stopping.
Yeah.
And that's sort of poking fun at pop and Justin Bieber and that sort of era of pop music from the late 00s and early 10s. So that'll be one I'll look forward to. And I think that we can... Oh, wait, the show isn't coming to an end just yet. You can't have dinner because when this movie came out, you know what? Roger Ebert was very much alive.
Yep.
There's always a look on your face. You're like, I forgot about that son of a bitch. It's okay. He's no longer with us. You've defeated him. But we have to hear from, do you think he likes Spinal Tap?
Yeah.
He did like Spinal Tap. Spoiler, he gave the film 4 stars.
Wow.
He gave the film 4 stars. He liked it quite a bit. Roger Ebert begins this review by quoting the Take It to 11 scene.
Oh, okay.
Not Roger Ebert says. Nigel is so baffled by this notion that he almost stops chewing his gum. These go to 11, he repeats finally. His faith in the extra push over the cliff is unshakable. Marty realizes he's dealing with a matter of guitar theology and not logic. Nigel has a few ideas, but they are clearly defined and defiantly defended. The filmmaker is helpless to face Nigel's rapture. This is Spinal Tap, is one of the funniest movies ever made. Now, that's something I've said about a lot of films, but this is one of them that is the way a real story is not the questions or is in the answers, but at the edge of the frame. There are 2 stories told in the film. The story of what the rock band Spinal Tap thinks, hopes, believes, or fears is happening. And the story of what is actually happening. The reason we feel such affection for its members is because they are so touching in their innocence and optimism, intoxicated by the sheer fun of being rock stars. They perform long after their sell-by date to smaller and smaller audiences for less and less money, still seeking the roar of the crowd. The fake documentary, released in 1984, was the directorial debut of Rob Reiner, then famous as Meathead from All in the Family, soon to become one of the most successful Hollywood directors. The Sure Thing, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, The American President. I'm assuming that just came out when he rewrote this. He plays Marty DeBerge, the dogged documentarian who follows along on Spinal Tap's first U.S. tour in 6 years. He was first attracted to the band, he says, by its unusual loudness, so perhaps he should be more grateful for Nigel's technical secrets. The band members are the blonde rock god David St. Hubbins, Michael McKean, named after the god of sensible footwear, the bass player Derek Smalls, Harry Shearer, and Nigel Tufnell, played by Christopher Guest, who longs for St. Hubbins' big, wet spaniel eyes. When Nigel learns that David's girlfriend, Janine, is flying over from England to join the tour, his heart sinks. His crush on David is obvious to everyone, except, of course, David. The 2 frontmen get in the most glory, while the drummer, Mike Shrimpton, supplies percussion on borrowed time. Previous Spinal Tap drummers have had an alarming mortality rate. One spontaneously combusted, and another one choked to death on vomit, but not his own vomit. Support for the band in the U.S. tour comes from a perfectly observed group of music industry functionaries. Their manager, Ian Faith, is like a weary scoutmaster, promoting a troop of mama's boys that the hike is about to be over. He carries a cricket bat and releases tension at crucial moments by such therapeutic activities as smashing TV sets. Bobby Fleckman is a record company publicist trying to explain without really explaining why the band's new album, Smell the Glove, is not in stores. Letterman band leader Paul Schaefer is Artie Fufkin, an advance man who fails to provide a single fan for an autographing. Fred Willard is an upbeat Lieutenant Hook Stratton in charge of their last U.S. concert, an officer's dance in the airplane hangar of a military base. Guest, McKean, Shearer, and Reiner wrote the screenplay themselves, benefiting from improvisational rehearsals, and they also wrote all the songs, some of which, like Sex Farm, became popular and really were not much worse than any other heavy metal hits. Guest liked the genre so much he directed 2 mockumentaries of his own, Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show. For Spinal Tap, heavy metal was the band's last stop on the odyssey that began with the boys as a folk group and saw them morph into the 60s flower power before emerging in their final form as Fearsome and Hairy. Their tour now features props like giant death's hand and alien pods, which give birth to them one by one. Or at least that's the plan. Reiner fills the frame with background information and subtle touches. Look at the way he uncertainly crosses his arms and uncrosses them while delivering Marty's introductory remarks. Yeah. The love triangle involving Nigel, David, and Janine is never overtly acknowledged. The disintegration of the tour is explained offhandedly in asides after the Boston concert is canceled. It isn't a college town. In an early scene, Nigel and David have lip rings. In a later scene, they have scars from the unsuccessful piercings. Dialogue makes its point by accurate word choices, as when David Smalls introduces a groupie as my new special friend. The biggest laugh in the second half of the film is assembled lovingly over time out of many small elements. It involves the assignment to set designer Polly, played by Angelica Houston, to build a replica of one of the elements of Stonehenge, which will descend from the stage during a big production number. Bad communication causes an error in scale. To appreciate the skill of Reiner and his editors, observe the way they prepare for the payoff. Instead of simply showing the erroneous prop descending from above, they include a scene where they are told that it will happen. Then, after intermediate footage to create anticipation, we see the disastrous moment. This is a rare case where it helps to know the punchline before it arrives. We are laughing not only at what happens, which is funny enough, but at the reaction of the band members, who have not been prepared. Seeing A Hard Day's Night recently, I was struck by how much fun the Beatles were obviously having. If there is a more joyous and orgasmic single scene in the movie than their She Loves Me number, I have not seen it. You can see Paul and John grinning at each other while singing, not at a performance technique, but because they just can't help themselves. Many musicians must go through that in the early stages when they want to pinch themselves because of their good luck. How we can taste how much love embodying their roles. David Edelston of Slate wrote, "This is Spinal Tap, was re-released, and why not? Who wouldn't want to be a rock titan, even a ludicrous and stupid and fading one? It's a supreme pipe dream of our era." He puts his finger on the film's deepest appeal. It is funny about Spinal Tap, but not cruel. It shares their pleasure in being themselves. It has an affection for these three fragile egos. Yes, they're spoiled. Yes, they make impossible demands. The scene involving the size of the bread for the dressing room sandwiches is a masterpiece of petulant behavior. Yes, their music is pretty bad, but they're not bad men. They're holy fools living in a dream that still somehow barely holds together for them. They deserve their last-minute rescue of their Japanese tour. Although, what have the Japanese done to deserve them? One of the loveliest ironies of This Is Spinal Tap is that the band took on a life of its own after the movie came out and actually toured and released albums. Spinal Tap lives still, and they haven't gotten any better. 4 stars.
Yeah.
He wrote the longest review just to keep you from dinner.
Yeah, that was longer.
Yeah.
But he loved it, and I'm glad that he loved a movie finally, you know, like I did.
All right. And with no objection, we'll see you guys next week, and we're covering Solo.
No, we're not.
We're not covering Solo. Doing Popstar.
Bye, guys.
We will see you guys next week.